This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Welcome back. I'm your host, Christopher Rose, with the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. My guest in the studio today is Robin Metcalf, who is the director of Food and City, which is housed in the College of Natural Sciences here at the University of Texas at Austin. And today we're going to be talking about food history. For this season of 15 Minute History, we're going to have a running sub-series of episodes about food history. And Dr. Metcalf has graciously agreed to come help us understand what food history is and why it's even important to talk about it. So we're happy to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let me start off with the question I just posed. You yourself didn't train as a food historian, as we were just discussing before we started recording. How did you stumble into this field?
It's one of those fields you sort of make up as you go along, because there isn't anything that really exists. You can't go into a college course catalog and look under the Department of Food History. You can't really even look within a history department and find a sub-department within it. So it's challenging if you're a student or a graduate student who's looking for a house or a home, shall we say, to go study your scholarship if you're interested in food. So I became interested in the topic of food history after 10 years running a conservation farm in Maine. So my Bachelor's of Arts, or BA, undergraduate degree, was from University of Michigan in American Studies a long time ago. But I've always been interested in American history, or history more broadly. And in the 90s, early 90s, I was traveling in Britain and came along their old historic houses, which a lot of people go and tour. But in the back of them were always these farms that were also historically accurate, portraying the story of the farmhouse, and also the point of preserving those types of breeds, shall we say, the historic breeds, or they're called right now, heritage breeds. And through the lens of those animals, talking about those animals and why they are becoming extinct, you learn about why they were domesticated in the first place, which very much brings you in contact with social history and economics. The particular sheep breed that caught my eye was the Cotswold sheep, which in the 1500s in England was the thing, it's like the oil industry is in our society, it was the thing that provided the economic foundation at that time, was that particular sheep breed, which provides a very strong staple or thread for making rugs and carpets, which were sold all over Europe at that time. The Chancellor of the Exchequer in Parliament today sits on a big hassock filled with Cotswold wool, really sitting on the wealth of England. So as you can see already, you're rapidly moving down the path of, well, there's all these stories through these animals that relate to that country's history and story. So having been a student of Earth Day, 1970, and being interested in conservation and in history, this sort of convergence of conservation and history was a natural thing. I got the idea that it would be cool to do something like that in the United States. So I started this farm, nonprofit, open to the public, very strongly oriented towards telling the story of heritage breeds in the American context, thus drawing on the American history to tell those stories. So as people toured the farm and met these animal breeds, you learned the equivalent of what I was learning in England. So I thought that was really interesting and a great marriage of sort of conservation, bringing agricultural diversity back into the landscape in contemporary times at the same time by raising the animals and getting them bred and dispersed across the United States. At the end of 10 years, we decided that we had done all we could up there in the state of Maine and moved down to Boston, where our children needed high schools that were going to get the job done. And I decided to go back to school. Now, I'd only had an undergraduate degree, so I was looking at a master's at that point in time. And Boston University has a great gastronomy program, not history of food, but a gastronomy program. And it is, or was, founded by Julia Child and Jacques Pepin, so it has wonderful roots in terms of that story. So I started there, thought I was going to look at agricultural history, because basically the same 10 facts that I was building into all of our educational material were the sum total of the scholarship that existed at that
right.
time. So it was intriguing. Let's go back and see if we can generate more scholarship. I know this is a long answer to your question, but you take what
Please
you want.
Continue.
You know. Anyway, so I went back as a master's student, was very much then convinced by one of the professors to get a PhD. And he himself, you know how a lot of your wanderings in school are determined by that one professor you meet who is your champion for a certain way of approaching scholarship or topic. And he convinced me to go into the history department at Boston University and work with him with his interest within food. So he was a medieval food historian, history of technology person, and a professor, Thomas Glick. And so I worked with him as his student pursuing that. So I just kept working with him. We developed a syllabus for other students that were interested in food history. Now, food history in general can be interpreted a lot of different ways. I could have gone down the road of just the history of different foods. You know, I mean, we get into sub-disciplines at a certain point in time. So you could look at the history of apples. There are a lot of food historians that really look at what we call ingredient history. Or you could look at the politics of food. And we have a professor here, Professor Patel, who looks more at that, you know, policy and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. There's history, and then there's the sub-disciplines of history that come into play. It's another way of telling a story about history, about how we got to today, about change. I mean, history is change over time. So if you want to look at change over time and how food played a role in that, that's really what food history ends up being. Migration patterns, wars. Lots of wars were fought over food. A lot of identities are interconnected with food, cultural and social identities. So there's lots to mine there, and it's a fresh way of looking at history. It's not the only way, but it was certainly a way that was of interest to me from that framework of having done that 10-year farm project.
It certainly seems to be a new and exciting way of getting people excited about history now, because as you've mentioned and as we've covered, food history can be cultural history, it can be social history, it can be economic history, it can be political history. And I think more importantly for people who define themselves as economic or social or cultural historians or political historians, it sort of messes up those subgenres of history because you have to look at all of them at once. I know from hearing you speak previously that teaching food history was a bit of a challenge at first. Would you relate some of that experience as to?
Absolutely. You know, because there's not, shall we say, a deep archive of syllabi and course material. Certainly very, very few, if any, textbooks that you can use as a food historian to teach. You pretty much have to make your own reader, you know, cobbling things together. The first class that I taught was based on a class that I taught at Boston University, which was in my area of study, which would be Western European or modern European food history. So you take that, you combine it with food, you tell the story from basically the French Revolution up to post-World War II. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the classic way one would go about teaching food history from that background. And I did that for 1-2 semesters. And each time having made the big reader, had gone through all those years and put all that out there. And even I found it not very interesting. And I can't imagine that the students would find it interesting if I didn't find it really. It didn't really, of course, push the envelope on the effort to create critical thinking within a course. It was, this is what Karem did, this is what that war was fought, and, you know, it's sort of like, okay, I got it, but how does it really impact me as a student, and mm-hmm. how does that shape this conversation that we're having out there and outside of the classroom? All these conversations about food are going on out there. I see the necessity for learning food history as a fundamental way of providing context for contemporary conversations. History is really that contextual information, that knowledge base. So if you come into a conversation about community gardens, about public spaces, about vertical farms, about genetic engineering, about any of the stuff that's sort of like on your BuzzFeed in the morning.
Right.
This context will help you understand how we got here, more or less what issues have been in the past, and perhaps create a better informed way of moving forward. So, yeah, it's the past informing the future, but it's fundamentally providing tools for critical thinking in that sense.
Were you able to rejigger, rethink your class in a way that made those connections?
Yeah, I think this last course that I taught was a, shall we say, a step in the right direction. I think there's still work to be done. I have not, found the gold standard on how to go about doing this by any stretch of the imagination, but I did put myself in, the student's point of view, how they would look at the world today and say, how would I find this course interesting? And thought, they walk around campus, they go to the breakfast taco place, they listen to conversations about food. How could I create a thread that would have some meaning in their everyday life? And that's when I started thinking, okay, two things should be in this course, which is when I look out the window in Austin as a student, how can I connect that landscape with what's going on inside this classroom? So that would be the kinds of food that you're eating, what's going on out there with gardens, what the conversation is with the city about public markets. How do we do that? And the second thing was I had thought about my arrival in this subject matter and the fact that it should not be a foregone conclusion that these students know how a food historian thinks, what tools they use as a historian. What does that workbench look like? Should you get a student really interested in a particular topic, how could you provide them the tools to really go further with that study? So that's sort of the workshoppy part of the course. So the first day of class, I start by bringing a breakfast taco in. And that's the textbook, if you want to. Very postmodern, So, but basically, that's something every student in that room probably has either seen or heard of is a breakfast taco. Funny enough, I had never had one before then. So that was a great opportunity for the teacher to get up to speed, right? Anyway, you could look at that breakfast taco and open it and look at the history of grains. You can look at basically Latin American history, transference of foodways, conquest. You can look at the meat, the pork inside, and look at the development of the cattle industry in Texas and how roads came about. And basically the meat industry, if you go down to Swift's Attic downtown, it's not by mistake that it's called Swift's Attic. It's where Adolphus Swift's office was in the transportation network between the stockyards in Fort Worth and moving down through Texas. So we just started by talking about how you would look at a breakfast taco if you were a food historian and began the course just as the introductory way of looking at that. Then it brought through the class professors of history and geography and professors who were pursuing food history through their own subdisciplines as historians and spoke about how they thought about food as a historian of technology, let's say, or of geography, let's say. Also brought in the gentleman who's the director of the Texas Historical Society Association Museum downtown.
Right.
And he talked about all the archives that are there, about all the different buildings in Austin and where they came from, where the cold storage units are below the restaurant Condesa downtown, why the railroad makes that bend in the curve and what it had to do with the delivery of meat and the meat business. So, and he has a lot of those really interesting archives. So between talking about the tools, bringing in experts who told how they thought about it, and also bringing in the landscape of Austin and what's going on there historically. It was fun. It was an exploration for all of us, discovery made. And at the very end, they generated their own project of interest to them, but they had to draw on all the subdisciplines and use all of the tools at the same time. So
that's a wonderful, I think, encapsulation of how food can get you into a whole bunch of different subdisciplines that you wouldn't even expect. To wrap up, I just want to ask you to talk a little bit about the Food Plus City project that you currently direct?
Right. Thank you for that that question. Food and City is a project that we started a couple of years ago. My scholarship is the public markets and cities, how cities are fed, basically, and how cities are shaped by the food system as well. And we decided to focus a project on that relationship of food and city, figuring that the world is becoming more and more urbanized. We are going to be living in virtual cities, if not real cities. So it really has an urban cast into terms of where we're going. So we do a couple of things. We have a magazine, both online and print, that talk about that subject. We also run a food challenge prize to, once people have learned about the subject, they want to become engaged in it, starting a business. We will support a challenge prize to encourage them to take the next step. So there's a bit of enterprise and entrepreneurship in the project as well. And the focus, the key fundamental focus in the food and city relationship for us this year is food distribution, because we really feel that that story is the connective tissue in any food system, and it is invisible by design. Therefore, it's not well understood. People get put off because it's the prosaic food logistics, you know, oh, tell me more, you know.
Right.
And we feel it's technology, it's human, it's important, and you really need to raise that subject and get to know it before you can really understand the totality of how we're going to feed cities in the future.
Wonderful. Well, I think this has been a great introduction to our year-long series, because I think it answers one of the most important questions, which is, why would anybody do food history? And I think you've really vividly explained how it's not just about the items that are put on the plate in front of you, but really about everything that has gone to bring them together. And I hope our listeners will keep that in mind as we move through the year. If you're interested in learning more about Food and City, the website is foodandcity.org, and I would encourage you to check out that project. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Christopher.
And we'll see you next time. For a transcript of this episode, images, and links to more information, visit our website at 15minutehistory.org. That's the numerals 15minutehistory.org. You can access our full catalog of episodes free of charge at our website and through the iTunes U app for iOS or the Tunes Viewer app for Android. You can also access the 10 most recent episodes through the Apple Podcasts app, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, and Overcast. 15 Minute History is produced in partnership between Not Even Past and the Hemispheres Outreach Consortium. Our executive editor is Joan Neuberger, and our technical editor is Christopher Rose. Our audio engineers are the awesome folks in the Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services, Jacob Weiss, Morgan Honecker, Will Kurtzner, Samantha Skinner, and Michael Heidenreich. Special thanks also to Michael DeLeon, iTunes U Site Administrator with Project 2021 and Educational Innovation. The University of Texas at Austin is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in episodes of 15 Minute History do not represent the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.